struck him, but I want to point out, I don't think I noted this before, there are actually two different halakim. There's Perek Aleph to Zion, which is what we talked about, and I will review it b'kitzer. And then there's a second half, which is a little shorter, which is Ches to Yud Beis. And they actually are two different themes. The common denominator is they talk about the unity of God. But Perek Aleph to Zion is about the unity of God and the creation. Meaning, that's the idea of there's nothing but God. Everything is God. We are just an illusion. Ein od mulvado. Does not the famous verse or the famous part of the pasuk, there is nothing besides Hashem, is interpreted to mean not that there is no God except God, but there is literally no mitzios except HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And I'll chazer that quickly, but that is the theme of Aleph Zion, the yichud, the absolute unity of Hashem and the Bria. Ches to Yud Beis deals with a more arcane philosophical topic, and that is unity within the different chalokim. Because we know that Hashem has machshava, Hashem has dibor, Hashem has maisa. We talk about the sviros, which seems to be different aspects of divinity. So the Alter Rebbe is going to show in Perek Ches to Yud Beis that the different chalokim kaviyocha of God are actually one. So there are actually two different aspects here. Aleph Zion is Hashem's unity with His creation, and Ches to Yud Beis is Hashem's unity within Himself. Now, I have to say that the controversial part of Shar HaYichud V'Emuna is the first aspect of Hashem's unity with creation. Now, just to chazer over again, the essential thesis of Aleph to Zion is to be masbir the idea of the Ari. The Arizal tells us that in order for Hashem to make room for a physical universe, HaKadosh Baruch Hu had to literally be mitzamtzem, which is normally translated as he had to contract himself, he had to shrink into himself, he had to roll up into himself, thereby creating what is called a chalal. Chalal is an empty, vacated space. And in that vacated space, there is the possibility of physical creation and materialism. And the issue is, how do you understand the idea of tzimtzum? The Sefer, again, I'm chazering a little bit, the Sefer, Mishnas Chasidim, Rav Munel Chayriki, who was a Talmud of the Arizal, understood what is called Simsum Kipshuto, that quite literally, God is not present in this physical world. He controls the physical world. He creates the physical world. He maintains the physical world, for sure. No one's denying that. If you denied that, you would be an apikoros. But he is not in the physical world per se. And Befrat, Rav Manuel Chayriki says, that is what Simsum means. And that refers to the what is often referred to, although I don't know if anyone uses that lashon in terms of the primary sources, Simsum Kipshuta, although that's not the actual lashon that the Sforim use. Clearly, that is the position of the Mishnas Chachamim. And many say that is the position of the Vilna Gaon. It's a little more tricky, because the Shaila is, when the Bala Tanya criticizes the mistake of those people who think they're wise, that Tzimtzum is literal. So again, some say he's actually referring to the Vilna Gaon, and some say he's not referring to the Vilna Gaon, because once again, for him to call the Vilna Gaon somebody who thinks he's wise in his own eyes would be a bit of a radical step. But remember, I think I told you that whole part of Shar Yichud V'Emuna was omitted from 1792 to 1900, meaning to say it was in the Ksav Yad of the Alter Rebbe. It actually did not appear in the printed Tanyas till 1900, because after all, the Tanya was printed in Vilna. Vilna was the main place before Chabad started printing Tanyas. Every city in the world, Vilna was the main. In fact, Vilna is was really the most famous Jewish printing press in history. This is the famous printing press of the Almana and the sons of Ram. Right, Ram is Reish Aleph Mem. Ram was the family name, and it was started by her husband, and her husband died, and all of the great Svarim, the famous Vilna Shas, every Shas today is an offset of the Vilna Shas. That Vilna Shas came from that particular defus.
Isn't that proof though? Why would the Baal Tanya not have printed it in if he wasn't arguing on the Gaon himself. If it was the Mishnah Chasidim and the Gaon really agreed to him.
Yes, I think the problem was that either, in other words, it's not a raya, because either way you learn, even if the Alter Rebbe did not mean the Vilna Gaon. But the pshat is, people thought he did. So Mimele, he didn't want to be Gairim Machlokas. By 1900 already, it was thought nobody understood this machlokas anyway, so there were other issues. It's reminiscent of a famous joke, they say, the way they describe Chassidim and Misnagdim today. He says there was a father-in-law who his daughters married two lamdonim, and he was going to support them in learning for many, many years. And one, he agreed to give a hot fleishik meal every day. I guess the brother-in-law didn't get along that well. And the other would get a hot milchik meal at a different time, you know, blintzes and cheeses, etc. And the brothers-in-law used to fight who was more chashuv, who was more esteemed. One said fleishik, one said milchik. You know, they were arguing over who was more chashuv. You know, kosher milchik can also be expensive. So after a few years, the shver, the son, the father-in-law, became an oni. He couldn't afford anything anymore. So all he could afford was potatoes. Elamai, he had a condition though that one was fleishik, one was milchik. So one got potatoes cooked in a fleishik pot, and one got potatoes cooked in a milchik pot. They both got the same potatoes, but one was fleishik, one was milchik. So they were still fighting who was more chashuv. So the shver calls them together and says, "Listen, in the olden days when you had real meat and you had real cheese, no, there's a machlokas who's more chashuv. Now it's all potatoes, a little taste of meat, a little taste of cheese. That's not going to define who is more chashuv." No, they want to say in the olden days, you know, Chassidim had real shitas and Misnagdim had real shitas. There was a real, real tif machlekes about what's going on. Today, you know, everything's potatoes. There's Chassidish flavored potatoes. There's Litvish flavored potatoes. It's all potatoes. Now, there are big machloksim, but the big machloksim that exist in the Chassidish and Litvish belt is not about shitas, and it's not about deus, and it's not about philosophy. It's about politics. Who controls this building? Who gets this yeshiva? You know, that's not a... that's a machlokas. That's just a machlokas. Meaning to say, it's not a machlokas about principle. It's not a machlokas about ideas. In terms of ideas, like nobody's... So maybe even by 1900 already, they said they could put it back in. No one's going to get that excited. No one's going to get that excited about it. But be it as it may, whether the person that the Alter Rebbe was referring to as being wise in his own eyes and making a big mistake was only the Mishnas Chassidim, or whether it was Mamish the Vilna Gaon itself, the Alter Rebbe rejects for sure the sheet of Tzimtzum Kipshuto, and he says it is not possible for any part of the world, whether it's the bathroom, no matter what it is, to be vacated of the divine light of God. God is present everywhere, and God is present in everything. That is, the Zohar says, "Less an asar panui minei." There is no place, no place, in which God is not present. He is sovev kol almin. He surrounds all the worlds, memale kol almin, and therefore the concept that certain places are holier than other places is technically not true. Mitzad HaKadosh Baruch Hu, God is equally present everywhere in every place, but we who live in a world of concealment, we are able to perceive Hashem more in some places than in other places. So when we say Eretz Yisrael is holier than other places, when we say the Beis Hamikdash is holier than the rest of Eretz Yisrael, when we say the Kodesh HaKadoshim is the holiest place, it does not mean Hashem is more present there than anywhere else. Hashem is equally present in North Dakota as he is in the Kodesh HaKadoshim. It's exactly the same. But mitzidenu, from our perspective, the ability we have to perceive God, the ability we have to connect to God, the receptivity of our neshama will be a function of certain places. Certain places, HaKadosh Baruch Hu reveals more of his light. So the Alter Rebbe's point is that Tzimtzum is not withdrawal. Tzimtzum is concealment. Hashem's light permeates creation. But in order for physical reality to exist, he had to hide a lot of his light, because otherwise we would just be obliterated in the totality of the light of God, just as a candle ceases to exist in the light of the sun. If you brought a candle up to the sun, it would just be totally absorbed in the sun. So as a result, the Alter Rebbe says, and he calls it an illusion, in order for us to have the illusion that we exist as autonomous beings, there had to be a concealment of the divine light, and therefore tzimtzum is not withdrawal, tzimtzum is concealment through many levushim, many garments, many obstructions, many coverings, and at various times Hashem reveals a little bit more, a little bit less. Right? Tzaddikim bring more of the light of Hashem into the world, mitzvos bring light of Hashem into the world, etc. But it's always a tiny, I mean, you can't even talk about fractions, it's only an infinitesimal part of the light of Hashem that's truly there, and therefore all of us, ein od milvado. Now, whether this turns into pantheism, as a letter from the Gra implied, everybody's God, everything's God. Now, I had mentioned that the Alter Rebbe was very concerned, as was Rav Chaim of Volozhin, that once you talk about the idea that God is in everything, this could chas v'shalom lead to very, very dangerous behaviors within religion, and Rav Chaim Volozhiner warned about it, and the Alter Rebbe warns about it. A person could say, for example, that sin is holy, because how could sin exist unless God is in the sin, is in the treif, is in the arayas, is in the murder, is in the chilul Shabbos? So why is there a difference in a mitzvah and avera? Or a person could say, I'll learn Torah in the bathroom because God's glory is everywhere. So that's why both the Nefesh HaChaim and Shar Gimel and the Alter Rebbe, and I say the Kuntrasim are almost identical. It's interesting, what we're going to talk about tonight, Ches Tzied Beis, is only in the Alter Rebbe. The Chaim Volozhin does not talk about that much. But the Aleph to Zion is mamish parallel to Shar Gimel. In fact, when I teach Nefesh HaChaim, I basically repeat, I have less time, but I repeat in a shorter way what I say here. So when people ask me for recording, they say, listen, if you have the Tanya, you don't need the Nefesh HaChaim recording for Shar Gimel. Which again raises the question, how could the Vilna Gaon be cholek on the Alter Rebbe if Nefesh HaChaim is so much like the Alter Rebbe in this? Okay, again, people are debating this at Hayom HaZeh. And the answer has to be, meaning, why should I keep mitzvos? And what's wrong with Averos? Everything is God, and why aren't I God? And why can't I say that I'm God? So he says, you have to have a double vision of reality. There is reality from Hashem's perspective, and then there's reality from our perspective, and the whole nature of tzimtzum is that we have to live a life as if we are an entity separate from God, and therefore behave accordingly as God's subjects, instead of being nothing more than a manifestation of God's presence. If all you are is a manifestation of God's presence, then in a sense you're denying Bechira, and you no longer see a difference in good and evil. But instead of regarding myself as nothing more than a manifestation of God's presence, I have to regard myself as an autonomous person who is God's subject. And as God's subject, I have free will, and I have a duty of obedience, and hence I have to keep the whole Torah. Right, that's the basic idea. And here, the Alter Rebbe has a few interpretations of Psukim that are very interesting. Again, forgive the review. First, he interprets the pasuk in Tehillim, Ki shemesh umagein Hashem Elokim. Hashem Elokim, yudke vavke, Elokim is shemesh, he is the sun, and the magein, and he is my shield. He is my sun, and he is my shield. So the Alter Rebbe explains that the two names of Hashem, these two names, Havaya, Shem Havaya, Yudke Vavke, literally means bringing everything into existence. That's what it means. It's a verb. Mahaveh. He brings everything into existence. That connotes the idea that the essence of God, it's not simply a question. In other words, the idea that Hashem is the neshama of the world is not quite accurate. Because although the neshama gives life to the guf, but the guf can exist without a neshama. It'll be dead. In other words, when a neshama leaves a guf, you still have a metzias. So to say Hashem is the neshama of the world is misleading, because that would suggest the world has an independent existence, but it wouldn't live without God. It's very, very different. This is a Bitul HaMetzius Mamish, that there is literally nothing but God's will that gets concretized into physical forms. He brings from the Baal Shem Tov, when he says in Tehillim, Li'olam Hashem Devorcha Nitzav Bashamayim, forever Hashem, your words stand in heaven. Says the Baal Shem Tov, when Hashem created the heaven, he said the words, Yehi Rakia. And that was a concretization of his will in the letters of the Aleph Beis. And it is those letters of the Aleph Beis that are keeping the Shamayim in existence, meaning, and not just the Shamayim, who had in the Aretz. Everything is nothing more than God's will. Now again, it's hard to understand. This is very abstract. It's not simply that things exist because of God's will. Everybody would say that. But rather, it's more than that. It is nothing but God's will, meaning to say the Rakia is the letters Yehi Rakia. That's what it is. It is God's will, not that God willed it to come into existence. It is a physical concretization of God's will through those letters of the Aleph Beis. And that's Li'olam Hashem Devorcha Nitzav Bashamayim. Indeed, it's recorded as the Alter Rebbe was dying, his last moments. He asked he was facing the ceiling, and he asked his Einikuch, what do you see when you look up at the ceiling? And they say, we see rafters, we see beams. He says, that's not what I see. He says, I see the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. That this nothing more than the words of HaKadosh Baruch Hu, which is the Ratzon of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now again, in this second Chelek we're going to look at shortly, he's going to show you how the words of God are the same as the essence of God. That's the unity within God itself. So, that's what Havaya is. Havaya is all existence is nothing but the will of God. Elohim, however, is the name of Hashem that conceals His divine light through the process of Tzimtzum so that we can exist. So now the Pasuk is so beautiful. The Shemesh gives light into the world. But we know that the brightness of the light of the sun has to be blocked. That number one. That's why we have an atmosphere. Without an atmosphere, Earth would be burnt. That's why even with an atmosphere, you know, don't go out in the sun too much. You got to wear sunscreen or whatever, long sleeve shirt, right? When untanned yeshiva boys go swimming, they almost always get some sunburn afterwards. In other words, you need protection from the sun. So he interprets a beautiful pshat. Shemesh umogein Hashem Elokim. The Hashem, the Havaya, is the Shemesh, and the Shem Elokim is the sunscreen, is the magen, that allows me to exist. Otherwise, I would be burnt up, so to speak. My existence would no longer be possible in the light of Hashem. And both are rachamim. See, this is the common mistake. We commonly say, Havaya is rachamim, and Elohim is Din. Now, it's true that if you define Rachamim as giving and Elohim as withholding, that's going to be true. But the Alter Rebbe points out the Din is also Rachamim, because if Hashem wouldn't withhold His light or conceal His light, we could not exist. So in a sense, the Din itself is Rachamim. Shemesh umagein Hashem Elohim, and the other pasuk I alluded to, Li'olam Hashem, from the Baal Shem Tov, Devorcha Nitzav Bashamayim, your words are still Makayim the Bria, which is your Ratzon. And then the other thing, again, there are a lot of different psukim that he's masbir, but he actually said that this kundris was devoted to explicating the meaning of a passage in the Zohar, where the Zohar says, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokim. Oh yes, one other thing. Elokim is also Hateva. In other words, the proof that Elokim is the concealment of divine light is the fact that the gematria of Elohim, the numerical equivalent of Elohim, is the same as the word ha-teva, nature. Right? Ha-teva is 16, is 86. Elohim is 86. Because what is nature? Nature is the great concealer of God, because nature is regular. Right? The world operates in a certain way every day. There is gravity. There is sunrise. There is sunset. There are seasons. So you could think, who says there's God? Or maybe God created a world and then left it to its own, like the watchmaker analogy. He's like a watchmaker, made a watch and wound a watch, and it's ticking of itself. So Elohim is not so much punishment. Elohim is really concealment and withdrawal to enable me to have the illusion of autonomy and control, which then gives me the power to make choices of serving HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Now, going back to the Zohar says, Shema Yisrael Hashem Elokeinu Hashem Echad is called the upper unity, and Baruch Shem Kavod Malchuso Leolam Voed is the lower unity, right? The Aramaic is, Shema Yisrael is Yichud Ila'a, Baruch Shem is Yichud Tata'a, lower. And the Alter Rebbe says, what is the explanation? What is higher unity? What is lower unity? So he says, it's exactly the difference between Hashem and Elohim. Shema Yisrael, Hashem Elokeinu, meaning in this world, Hashem, the light of God, appears to us as Elohim through concealment. In reality, Hashem Echad, Hashem is one, meaning not that there's one God. I mean, that's how we normally interpret it. But Hashem is everything. Everything is one with God. That's the higher unity, because that basically says there is nothing but God. Meaning, I am not here. Again, the abstract idea here is, it's not that I'm here because of God's will. Rather, I am just a concretization of the will of God. The only thing there is the will of God. I am the will of God. In me are the words, in every person, Nase Adam. Now, however, Yichud Ilah, if you took that as the only Hashgafa, there would be no Bechira, there would be no free will, there would be no point in doing mitzvos, everything is God, no matter what you are, is God, God, everything is God. So for that we have Baruch Shem, and that is called the lower Yichud, because here is the Knesset. How do you see the lower Yichud? Because in Baruch Shem, we talk about God's kingship. Baruch Shem, blessed is the name of the glory of His kingdom. Now here's the Knesset, the Alter Rebbe says. In order for a king to have a kingdom, a king must have subjects. And these subjects have to be independent of the king. Right? A king can't look at his 10 fingers and say, you know, I rule over my fingers. Ein melech below am. And therefore, Baruch Shem Kavod, if Shema Yisrael emphasizes the unity with God, Baruch Shem reminds me that in the world of Elohim, I have to have a sense of being separate from God. Right? That's Elohim. And that's Kavod Malchuso. And that is Yichud Tata. So in a sense, I think, although the Baal Tanya is not so explicit, that the meaning of upper unity is the unity that Hashem sees, and lower unity is the unity we perceive, in which we are one with Hashem in the sense that we are autonomous, we are His nation, but we have a sense of separate being through Tzimtzum, which allows us and obligates us to keep His service. Yeah.
How would you tie this in with when I was teaching, where I teach the echad is really a person has bitachon and emuna, that the echad means that whatever happens, in realizing that God is behind you. You know, you do your nishtabas, of course. But something happens and you're the lottery, this, and all of a sudden someone gets a flat tire. You're taking everything is coming from Hashem, and if you said the word echad equals love, it's all of God's love, God's involvement. The kavana, when you say Shema, what kavana should we have? The kavana that you are doing a very high level of kavana.
No, no, so, so
I'm giving a lower kavana of saying,
I understand.
Happens in our life, you say, I'm accepting you as Hashem Echad, that what looks to me as something positive, something else that may be tsar, pain, everything is coming from Hashem.
Yeah, that's a simpler pshat, but that's also a very, very good pshat. That seems to be what Rashi says, and the Kliyoka, the way you interpret it is this. Hashem Elokeinu, you simply look at it in the standard way. Yudke Vavke is Rachamim. Elokim is Din and punishment. So in this world, we sometimes see good things from God, and sometimes bad things. We have to understand Hashem Echad, it's all coming from the Rachamim of HaKadosh Baruch Hu. Yeah, that's a perfectly...
I'm asking what Kavanah... Yeah. Should ask a simple
I think most of us simple Jews should focus on this basic kavana. I think what you're saying is one of the basic kavanas, that whether it's good or bad, whether it feels to us as good or bad, it's all coming from the highest level of rachamim. But this is a kabbalistic interpretation. I mean, this is from the Zohar. Yeah, not bad. In other words, what seems to us
painful or difficult.
Right. No, of course. Yeah, yeah.
It says the word bad is a chakra.
Right.
There's no bad.
That's what the Mishnah says. A person must bless Hashem for well. The Mishnah uses the word ra. Chayav adam levarech al hara. So so lamaisa, such a lashon is used. But you are correct.
But you can't verbalize.
Right. The ultimate hashkafa is everything Hashem does is for the good. So that's again a chas v'shalom. I'm not at all negating that kavana. That seems to be the kavana of Rashi. And the Kliyokar is Masberet, the Feirish. But the Balatanya brings from the Zohar that these are different levels of Yichud. Yichud Ila'a, Yichud Tata'a. My only question is, I think I raised this question, is that according to at least one Maimar Chazal, Moshe Rabbeinu stole the praise of Baruch Shem from the Malachi Hashares. Now it seems, since Malachi Hashares are not Balei Bechira, they have no real connection to the second aspect of Yichud. Their only idea is that everything is God. So it's interesting that Yichud Tata should come from the Malachim. I think it's a little incongruous in that sense. Okay, so that basically, again, forgive me for reviewing, but I think this material is dense enough that it's kedai to chazer it a little bit. But that's kind of the tamtzitz of Parakim Aleph Zion. And as I say, the most famous controversial part is when he criticizes those people who think they're chachamim, and say simsum kipshutim. Again, to say he's saying it on the Vilna Gaon is shver. But the emes is even on the Mishnah's chachamim is difficult because it's Mishnah's chasidim. Mishnah's chachamim is another thing. But Mishnah's chasidim is difficult because it is a bit derogatory. And Lamaisa, the Baal HaTanya, quotes the Mishnah's Chassidim many times in the Tanya as a good authoritative sefer of Kabbalah, even though he's cholek on him in this particular union. So again, it's still a bit of a mystery who is the Baal HaTanya directly referring to. In any case, in Perek Ches to Yud Beis, he goes on another theme, and it could be, in the Nefesh HaChaim, Rav Chaim Volozhiner talks about a big aveira when people pray to the sviros. Right? We talk about Hashem as these 10 sviros, chesed, gevura. So when people pray to the svira of chesed, so Rav Chaim Volozhiner calls that aveira zara mamish, and chas v'shalom, it's not shayach to direct a prayer to any of the sviros. That would be the same as praying to the sun and the moon and other things. They are carrying out the will of God, but they are not God, and how can you pray to the spheres? So, although obviously this was written before the Nefesh Chaim, it seems that, and maybe Rav Chaim was criticizing the Baal HaTanya, the Baal HaTanya seems to say it's okay, because the Baal HaTanya basically says all of these levels are totally unified within God, meaning to say that things like Sviros seem like separations, divisions, only from our human perspective. But HaKadosh Baruch Hu is a total unity. And therefore, Chesed, Gevurah, Tiferes, it's all one God. Now the Emes says, Rav Moshe Cordovero actually gives a mashal to this. Rav Moshe Cordovero compares the Sviros, the Ramak, to different colored glasses. So if you have blue glasses, red glasses, green glasses, and you pour clear water into the glasses, so when the water is in the red glass, it looks like red water from the outside, and when it's in the blue glass, it looks like blue water. So it looks different, but in fact, that itself is only the mask, that is only the cover. Intrinsically, it's the same. So Rav Moshe, the Ramak says, the Sviros are simply like different colored glasses through which a single divine energy is going through, and therefore, once again, that sense of multiplicity within God, that the Sviros may connote, is only mitzad our perception. Now, the truth of the matter is, although this has a Kabbalistic flavor, this is already something that Chazal spoke about. Chazal spoke about sometimes Hashem is Racham, sometimes Hashem is Midas Adin. It's all one Midah. There's only one God. And He manifests itself in different ways. Infinity is infinite. And if infinity is infinite, so there are infinite faces to infinity. So every time you see something, you're seeing a face of the infinite. So that does not suggest multiplicity. It's all, everything is one unlimited aptus. Now, the Alter Rebbe does not say beferish, you can therefore pray to a Sphira. But it seems that he's kind of setting the ground that Sviros are not an entity that are distinct from HaKadosh Baruch Hu. It is simply a perception that we have. In fact, the Kadosh Baruch Hu's Achdus is totally one. And he quotes the Rambam. He has a long quote from the Rambam. In fact, the Rambam uses this idea of Achdus to explain, I put in quotation marks because the Ravid is very angry at this explanation. The Rambam explains a very famous philosophical question. That's one of those famous philosophical questions, and that is, on one hand, we believe every human being has free will. Hashem does not decree if you are righteous, if you are evil, that is your decision. And the Rambam justifies this by saying, if we did not believe in Bechira, how could Hashem punish you for doing evil if you were programmed to do evil? And why should Hashem reward you for doing good? You're just doing what you're programmed to do. The very fact that there is reward and punishment presupposes human responsibility and human bechira. Moreover, to put it another way, it's almost the same idea, part of the purpose of reward and punishment is to create incentive and deterrent. Concept is, reward motivates me and punishment deters me. Right? That's the, you know, even in secular law, that is a function of punishment. And reward, carrot and stick, deterrent and encouragement. But if there's predetermination, it's not going to affect me one way or the other. So what's the point? Right? So these are slightly two different arguments. In other words, the first argument is, it wouldn't be just to reward or punish unless I had a choice. That's the justice argument, the yashrus argument. And the second argument is, it would have no point to reward or punish if it's not going to change my behavior. So because of this, the Rambam says, it's a davar pashut, that Judaism believes in free will. Okay, everyone knows that. And then the Rambam goes to a lot of questions. We're not going to go over it tonight. So how could Hashem harden Paro's heart, etc.? And he gives different answers, that that was a punishment for Paro hardening his own heart initially. But then the Rambam asks the question that everybody asks, even little kids ask the question. Gee, Hashem knows the future. Hashem knows what you're going to do before you do it. Hashem knew what you're going to do today, yesterday, 100 years ago, 10,000 years ago, 10 million years ago. So you say, when I wake up tomorrow morning, I have free will to daven or not to daven. How do you have free will? Hashem already knows whether you're going to daven or not to daven. So the choice was already made in the past. How do you reconcile free will with divine knowledge of the future? Now, one answer that's given is this. The Rambam doesn't give this answer exactly, although he might mean this answer, but he doesn't really say it. But one answer that's given is the kasha that if Hashem already knows, how can you have freedom? Is a kasha only when you live in a universe of time. Because in a universe of time, the past is earlier than the present. So if the past is earlier than the present, then your choice was already made. By the time you wake up Monday morning, you don't have a choice because that choice is already known. But you see, that's not the way God sees the future. God does not see the future by sitting in the past and looking at the future. Since God is above time, God sees all actions as if they are, this itself is not quite accurate, as if they are in the present moment. Now, once you understand that, then it's no kasha. If I see you davening shacharis, so I know you're davening shacharis, I'm not taking away your choice. I'm just observing what it is that you're choosing. So, from a Kadosh Baruch Hu's perspective, even if it was 10 million years ago, from his perspective, it's the present moment. In other words, you understand, it's only in a world of time that the past is before there is the present. Memela, you don't have a choice anymore because it's already, the word already, it's already done. But from Hashem's perspective, he's viewing you in the present moment. Right? That would be because he's above time. Now, the Rambam doesn't quite say that. The Rambam says something else, but you might interpret it this way. What does the Rambam say? Yeah.
I just want to say, I just want to ask, since, yeah. So even though Hashem is not bound by time, he's still dealing with a world that is bound by time. So I don't understand how that argument makes more sense, because he's looking at a world that is bound by time. So how could he look at the present, when the future?
Well,
the future?
Because he's not subject to the boundaries of the world, meaning to say he is...
But we are...
I understand. So that's exactly what the Zohar means when it says he is Sovev Kol Almin Umamale Kol Almin. He fills the worlds and he surrounds the worlds. Meaning to say, he is capable of simultaneously existing. I mean, ultimately it is a mystery, but he is capable of simultaneously existing within the bounds of the universe and outside of the bounds of the universe. And therefore the bounds of time are not going to affect his perception. Now, let me tell you what the Rambam says, because maybe this would shed a little light on your question. The Rambam says like this. You're asking me a question that God's knowledge seems to contradict free will. Right? That's the question, God's knowledge. But the Rambam says, God is an indivisible unity. Unlike a human being, where there's me and there's my knowledge. Knowledge is only a component, right? In other words, I am a human, and as I see things, as I learn things, I acquire knowledge. But my knowledge and me are two different entities. But since Hashem is not a divisible unity, God is an indivisible unity, then by definition, his knowledge and his essence are exactly one, are exactly the same. Therefore, the Rambam says, I can't give you an answer. I can't answer the question of how God's knowledge can exist when there's free will, because if God's knowledge and God's essence are the same thing, and God's essence is unknowable, then his knowledge is unknowable as well. Now, this is a fancy way of saying that this is an impossible question to answer, based on the postulate of the indivisibility of God's knowledge from God's essence. So this annoyed the Ravid somewhat. The Ravid basically says, in somewhat of a cantankerous way, the Ravid sometimes gets angry at the Rambam, and he says, if he couldn't answer the question, He shouldn't have asked it to begin with. Why is he asking a question that he doesn't answer? Now, the Ravid gives a question, which I think gives an answer, which Lami Asdaiti is even more difficult than the Rambam's answer. The Ravid, and again, maybe it's much deeper than I understand it, but at least the way I understand it, it's very difficult. The Ravid says an amazing thing. He says, God's knowledge of the future is not actual knowledge of the future, but it is predictive accuracy to the level of 100%. Meaning like this. All of us can make predictions, right? For example, you have bechira to daven tomorrow or not to daven. But if I know you, I could pretty much guess what you're going to do. Or, right, you go home to mom, and mom offers you vanilla or chocolate ice cream. Now, you could choose either one, but she kind of knows what you're usually going to choose. Now, we don't have perfect predictive accuracy because we don't know everything about a person. We don't know every single thing that ever happened to a person, so we can't predict. But the Ravid suggests it is not Hashem's knowledge of the future that gives him knowledge of the future. It's God's knowledge of the past. Since HaKadosh Baruch Hu knows every single thing that already happened, his predictive accuracy, l'gabe the future, is going to be 100%. Not because he sees the future. In fact, the Ravid seems to suggest that that would be a logical impossibility. Again, because it didn't happen yet. What is it that you see? It didn't happen. Well, again, you're getting into a lot of conundrums here. Elamai, God predicts the future. Well, if he predicts the future, maybe he'll be wrong. The answer is no, but God has a predictive accuracy rate of 100% because he has perfect knowledge of the past. That's what the Ravid suggests, the way I understand it. Again, I might be wrong here. The problem with the Ravid is that if the Ravid is saying that all decisions a person makes are a product of his past, that seems to torpedo free will legamri. This was exactly the position, Lahavdil, of the famous American behavioral psychologist at the beginning of the 20th century, John Watson. Watson famously stated that if we knew every single thing that ever happened to you, every single thing, we could predict exactly how you would behave because you are nothing more than the product of everything. Now, the reason we can't predict is nobody knows everything that happened to you. Now, Watson is called, deterministic. I mean, this is called determinism. Watson basically says there is no free will because everybody is a product of not just genetics, but of everything that happened to them, their environment and the like. So, to me, the Ravid is a very, very dangerous idea. Because if the Ravid is saying, God knows exactly what you're going to do. I mean, the Ravid is trying to answer, how do you have Bechira? If God knows. The answer, well, God doesn't know, God predicts. So why is God always right? Because he knows everything you did in the past. Well, if you're telling me, if I know everything you did in the past, I could predict what you do now, then you're actually saying there is no free will to begin with. It's a tzorichi and gadol. Again, for sure there's something that I don't fully understand in the Ravid, but the formulation of the Ravid seems to, instead of answering free will, the formulation of the Ravid seems to destroy free will, which is certainly not the Ravid's kavana. Yeah?
Just a question. My understanding that the way that free will works is that we can make the choices on the way to a path, but if we're going off the path, Hashem puts us on the direction he wants to be. Like, meaning, like, this is what I mean. That if a person is has a choice to do good and bad during the day, but at the end of the day, if he's supposed to be a lawyer, he'll become a lawyer. If he's got a different track to become a trainer, eventually he'll go back to a lawyer.
Yeah,
so I don't understand how free will really works.
This is very, very complicated. And this actually ties into the Tanya ultimately, because remember, the Tanya seems to set up the whole idea of free will as kind of an illusion, that we're not really free, we're just God's will, etc. And in the Sifrei Chassidus, they speak about this quite a lot, and that is there are two principles that work at the same time. There is free will, and there is God that has a predetermined plan for every person. And that plan is going to happen one way or the other. You can take highways and byways and detours and turns, but you're going to come out where it was the decree of Hashem that you do come out. This was the idea, in fact this was a very controversial idea, that even the sins that a person commits, even though he was not supposed to commit those sins, were a part of God's plan to bring him to a certain place and a certain realization. Now these ideas were so controversial that in some of Rav Tzadok's form they were censored and the like. But on a more simple level, I can just say, without getting into that difficult, controversial idea, it is true that Hashem will put into our lives experiences based on the choices that we make. When we choose to want to be good, Hashem will give us opportunities that will encourage us in that way. When we choose to do bad, Hashem will put in opportunities and temptations that will lead us in a bad way. Now that's not a direct interference with free will, that just means the type of life Hashem will give you is going to be connected to the choices that you make. So when you choose bad, it'll become harder to choose good because Hashem will put more and more temptations in your path. This is the famous statement of Chazal, the path that a person chooses to go is the path that Hashem will lead him on.
Isn't it the other way around? Like, if a person chooses good, won't Hashem put like obstacles in your way to really test you to see?
Yeah, right. So that's complicated. It works both ways. In other words, Chazal normally take the position that when a person chooses the good path, Hashem will put opportunities for him to consistently choose good. But that may only be if he's demonstrated his true commitment by passing a lot of obstacles first. So in a sense, the initial point may be obstacles and difficulties. Then when Hashem sees you're sincere, he'll try to give you a smooth sailing. So again, these things are complicated because there are contradictory phenomena that are going on. In fact, in real life, it's always a dilemma. Let's say you're debating whether you should pursue a certain course of action. Should I change yeshivas? And you encounter all sorts of obstacles. Nothing's working out. So what do you say? Do you say, that's a sign from Shemayim, I'm not supposed to make the change? Or do you say, this must be such a wonderful change that the Yetzer Hara is working overtime to create obstacles? There is a hashgava that if you find something difficult, that means that's where you're supposed to go. There's another hashgava that says when you find something difficult, Hashem is telling you don't go there. So how do you know? Sometimes it's that, sometimes it's that. How do you know? How do you know? What do they say? They say, I'm trying to remember, by the Akedah, that's a famous sport. That's a famous, famous sport. I don't remember the whole thing, but when Hashem told Avraham to shecht Yitzchak, Avraham goes along with the idea, right, or take your son as a korban, he goes along with the idea right away. When the Malach tells him not to shecht Yitzchak, so he needs some convincing. He argues, I want to do it, etc. Remember? So the question is, why is he so agreeable to take Yitzchak as a korban, but when he's told he could cancel it, he's a little more reluctant? Kind of strange. So I think they say, because when Hashem is telling you to do something that's really hard, then you know it's from Hashem. When he tells you to do something that's easy, that might be the Yetzer Hara fooling you. So when he says, take Yitzchak, he knows that's from Hashem, because that's hard. When he says, don't slaughter Yitzchak, that's easy. Maybe that's my Yetzer Hara talking at that point. I don't know for sure it's from a Kaddish Baruch Hu, but okay. Alrighty. So basically, therefore, in Ches, he's arguing for the total unity of God, that God is one. God's knowledge is one with his essence. The Sviros are one, etc., etc., etc. Now, the Pasuk in Iyov tells us, Mipsari Echaze Eloka. This is a Pasuk that the Baal HaTanya uses a million times, and this is a foundation of Chabad Chassidus. From my flesh, I perceive God. That means we try to understand Hashem by analyzing how we think and how we work, and in some ways, we're an infinitesimally small microcosm of how God works, right? From the human being, we try to understand Hashem. Now, in the human being, if you think about how you get from the most abstract thoughts to tangible action, there are actually five stages that you go through. Stage one is called Ratzon. And these are subconscious stages. The Ratzon is, there is a desire to do something. Because I want to build a house, I want to go somewhere. There's Ratzon. And then there is Chachma. Chachma is the initial wisdom, which gets developed in Bina, Chachma and Bina. Then there are Midos in your Neshama, Chesed, Gevura, right, etc. The Midos then actualize into Machshava, conscious thought, Dibor, conscious speech, and Maisa, tangible Maisa.
What is
Maisa? Maisa is action. Action, action. So, you have this hierarchy. Ratzon, Chachma, including Chachma Bina, Midos, different Midos get activated, and then they get translated into Machshava, thought, speech, Maisa, action. So obviously, since Machshava is conscious thought, that means those prior levels are not operating in a conscious level, because Machshava would be the thought, would be the first consciousness we have. Now, the Alter Rebbe says, once you enter the realm of consciousness, you enter the realm of letters and words, because even conscious thoughts are normally verbalized in some way. Right? A thought. Right? A thought is already, this is called osios hamachshava, the letters of the thought, which then become the letters of the word, which then gets carried out into action. Now he says, from the perspective of the human being who is infused with divine energy, because all of this comes from divine energy, he says each lower level contains only a fraction of the energy of the upper level. It only captures part of it. In other words, for example, the person's chachma activates a certain midah, whether it's kindness, strictness, whatever it would be. But the midah is only a fraction of the chias, of the divine energy of the chachma. And when the midah gets translated into machshava, that only captures a fraction of the midah. And when the machshava, now at this point we can actually understand, when the machshava gets concretized into speech, now this already we can understand. A person has thoughts, right? You want to put your thoughts into words. I think all of us experience the idea that our words don't really capture the totality of our thoughts. Right? Meaning to say, the koach of the osios of the machshava is much, much greater. Meaning that tzimtzumim, the contractions are occurring at every level. You see, the machshava is mislabesh. It dresses itself in the osios of dibor, but in a lesser concealed form. So he says, with HaKadosh Baruch Hu, it works the same way. With HaKadosh Baruch Hu, we have the Ein Sof, the infinite light of God, that eventually manifests itself in God beginning the creative process. And the beginning of the creative process, again, this will be a little bit Kabbalistic. Remember the four worlds. The four worlds, Atzilus, emanation, Bria, creation, Yetzira, formation, this world. Now, each of these worlds has the full complement of the 10 spheros. So there's Chachma, Bina, Das in the world of Atzilus and the 10 spheros. And then the light goes down into the world of Bria, the world of Yetzira, the world of Asiya. So the beginning of God's revelation in physical reality is the Chochmah of Atzilus. Does that make sense? Because before the worlds, there is no beginning of any type of creation. There is just the light of God. So the first world, which is utterly spiritual, but it's still a world, is the world of Atzilus. And what is the first spark of the divine revelation in the world of Atzilus? It is the Chochmah of Atzilus. So that's why the common phrase is, the Chochmah of Atzilus is the Reishis Hiskalus, the beginning of revelation is in the Chochmah of Atzilus. And the Chochmah then combines with Bina, and then it activates Midos, and then it goes down to the Bria, to Yetzira, to Asiya. So now, here is the point. Again, the point is very, very deep, and I am just going to try to give a pashut pshat here. By the time we reach the world of Asiya, when God is actually going to physically create, we have completed the activation of all of the Midos of Hashem, and now those Midos are going to be revealed through Machshava, God's thoughts, God's speech, God's action. Now Pirkei Avos indeed describes the creation of the world or the universe as Asara Ma'amorais Nivra Ha'olam, 10 utterances was the world created. Utterances, Dibor. So he explains that just as from my thought to my speech only captures a fraction of my thought, so God's Dibor, God's final Dibor, is a tzimtzum, is the ultimate contraction and compression of His divine light into particularized channels of energy that create physical reality. And those particularized channels are the 22 letters of the Aleph Beis, each of which is a particular conduit. So when we say God created the world by speech, the Alter Rebbe says that doesn't mean God actually said something. In other words, if you would be there somehow, you wouldn't hear a word. But rather, speech is a metaphorical idea. Just as speech is a revelation of a thought, but it only captures part of the totality of the thought, Hashem's speech, but it's Megala. What does speech do? Speech reveals the hidden thought, but in a compressed manner. It does not reveal the totality of the thought. So God's speech, in quotation marks, simply means the final concretized manifestation of God's will in a way that it can now be revealed in physical reality. And that is what we mean by a mimer. Mimer is a statement. And the way that gets revealed is through the 22 influences of the Aleph Beis, together with word combinations. In other words, the point to keep in mind is each letter of the Aleph Beis has a specific spiritual energy. But when letters are combined in a certain way, it is literally like a chemical reaction, right? When you take hydrogen and you take oxygen and you combine them in a certain way, you get something new. You get water. So the Aleph represents one type of spiritual concretization of divine energy. And the Beis represents another channel of divine energy. In fact, the Alter Rebbe even says that the shapes, we don't even know what this means, the shapes of the letters represent the nature of the divine energy they represent. So Aleph is a certain divine energy, and Beis is a certain divine energy. But when you combine, let's say, Aleph, Resh, Yud, Ari, Ari means lion, you don't just get the power of the Aleph, the power of the Resh, the power of the Yud. Rather, you get a new chemical synthesis that when these energies combine, they produce a certain thing, and that thing they produce will be a lion. You know, I think I mentioned it before, but it's good to mention again. Mark Twain, who was kind of an atheist towards the end of his life, so Mark Twain once wrote a satirical piece. He was making fun of the Bible. And he had the imaginary story, well, the imaginary dialogue. Adam names all the animals. So Eve says to him, when Adam named the lion, because he's working in English, Adam named the lion. So Eve says, why'd you call that thing a lion? So Adam says, he looks exactly like a lion. What do you want me to call him? Right, obviously that's a joke because it wasn't a lion until he called it a lion. But if you substitute the Hebrew word aryeh, aryeh was probably the correct word, or ari or aryeh, Adam's answer is exactly right. Because here is what the Baal HaTanya says. How did Adam know to give certain names to animals? The answer is, Adam looked by X-ray vision at the spiritual DNA, the spiritual energy of what a lion was made of. Remember, as the Baal Shem Tov said, Le'olam Hashem Devorchen, all we are made up of these channels of divine energy concretized through the letters of the Aleph Beis. Right? The Dibor, that's what I mean by Dibor. We don't mean speech. We mean Hashem taking his machshava and bringing it out through the channels of the letters of the Aleph Beis. So Adam HaRishon sees the spiritual composition of this lion is the Aleph combined with the Resh, combined with the Yud, combined with the Hay. So it's called an Aryeh. In fact, that is why the Ramban writes, Hebrew is called Lashon HaKodesh. Why is Hebrew called the holy language? So the Rambam, Maimonides, says, because there is no obscene, any obscene words in Hebrew are from Arabic today, but Hebrew itself does not have anything obscene, pornographic, and like. That's what the Rambam says. That's a negative reason. It doesn't have improper things. Ramban gives a Kabbalistic reason, that since it was through the power of the Hebrew letters that Hashem created heaven and earth, this is the language of creation. So, the Baal HaTanya says, the idea of mamoros, statements, does not really refer to talking. It refers to channeling divine energy through the letters of the Aleph Beis to create what we think is physical reality. And that itself is the process of tzimtzum. God contracted his light until it was able to be in these channels giving rise to these different things. He even goes on and says, he's very, very specific in a lot of this. He says, okay, there are 10 mamaros. Now the 10 mamaros actually don't say aryeh, meaning to say, God said, let there be light, let there be animals. Okay, but that didn't say lion, tiger. I mean, what does it mean? Doesn't say dog, doesn't say stone. So the Baal HaTanya says like this. The Baal HaTanya says, everything was created through these 10 mamaros because of the following. Because in addition to the primary words, we have what are called chilufim utmuros. Now, by that we mean the following. Every letter of the Aleph Beis can be transmuted in a different way. So, for example, we have like codes. Atbash. Atbash means you reverse the Aleph Beis. Like Aleph equals tough, etc. So as a result, a word rakia in various ways can then be used to spell sun, moon, stars. Everything has its own DNA, but it's coming from the mimer of rakia. So the mimer of rakia means the firmament, through various letter transpositions, gives rise to every single thing in the heavens, stars, planets, whatever it would be, galaxies, through a different so if you look at their DNA, you would see some letters in Hebrew, whatever they would be, and that would correspond to some tamura, some transposition of the word rakia. Aretz would be the same thing. So therefore, he makes the point that the Asura Mamaros give rise to all physical reality through derivative transpositions of the letters. And this can work in many ways. Now, he's not Marich in exactly how that works, but the Ramak, for example, has a big Arichas. This can be done through Gematrias. You can take the Gematria of an Aleph and then turn it into other letters. This can be done through Atbash, in which you have a code in which first letter becomes last letter. And then you can do Atbash of Atbash. You can keep on going and going and going and going, etc. And he does make a point, interestingly enough, that the further it is from the original mimer, the more attenuated is the divine energy. In other words, if something is only one level removed, it's at a certain level of divine energy. If it's two levels removed, three levels removed, four levels removed, the divine energy is going to be more and more attenuated in the domain, the inanimate and the like. But he says, well, that's the process of creation. The process of creation is when God brings his machshava into a giloy. A giloy is a revelation. And the revelation comes through the concretization of divine energy in the letters of the Aleph Beis. And the reason that is called a dibor or a mimar is not because Hashem verbalized it, but because just as a dibor is megala, it reveals a machshava, so too God's divine light was revealed through the process of the concretization through the 22 letters of the Aleph Beis, which then underwent many more transitions through gematria, through reversing of the order, and the like, through transposition of letters, through atbash and various other formulas, till you get every single physical reality that exists in the universe has its own DNA encoding based on the 22 letters of the Aleph Beis. Okay? And all of that, even though it looks like a multiplicity, it looks like a separation from God's ultimate chokhmah to the final maisa, but because of the unity of Hashem, Hashem is in everything, and therefore it is not separated from HaKadosh Baruch Hu at all. Alright, so this is Bekitzer, just the Pashat Pshat in difficult ideas, Shari Yichud V'Yamuna. I mentioned the Alter Rebbe had a Talmud, Rav Aaron of Starosilya. And Rav Aaron of Starosilya learned with the Alter Rebbe for 30 years. He was really, really very, very close. But he was not a son, so as a result he did not become the next Chabad Rebbe. The next Chabad Rebbe became the Alter Rebbe's son, called the Mittler Rebbe. So Rav Aaron kind of dropped out of Chabad and started his own Chassidus, even though he was the closest, really, to the Alter Rebbe. And he himself wrote a sefer with the identical title to the Chelek Beis of the Tanya. It's called Shar HaYichud V'Yamuna, because he said that unfortunately the Alter Rebbe was very much makatzer and did not fully develop the ideas that he had taught, and Rav Aaron wrote a sefer much longer than this to elaborate on those ideas. You can get the sefer. It's a very, very difficult sefer. And again, Chabad has a love-hate relationship with Rav Aaron. On one hand, he was the closest Talmud of the Alter Rebbe. On the other hand, he didn't stay in Chabad. He kind of went off on his own. But I remember just reading, just in passage, that the Rebbe, the last Rebbe of Nachum Mendel, was reading Rav Aaron's sefer on Hayichud V'Yamuna, and the Rebbe was heard to mutter under his breath, "This is a deep sefer." Meaning to say, apparently, it's a much more complicated and in more detail than the Tanya here. But for our purposes, l'chol hapachas, I hope you at least have all of us should have at least a pashut pshat as to the great beauties, number one, of the Aleph Beis itself. I think the most important thing that you get away from this last section is how the Aleph Beis is literally the genetic code of the universe. It's quite an amazing idea, and that's based all on the Baal Shem Tov. The Baal Shem Tov says, Li'olam Hashem, Devarcha Nitzav Bashamayim. Your words, so to speak, the spiritual energy in the letters of the Aleph Beis are Makayim the Bria, and that is connected to the idea of Tzimtzum. Okay, so at least for now, again, we'll go back, Mirza Hashem, we'll go back to these ones. We finished the Shaar Yichud V'Amunah. The next is also a short kuntris. We won't spend too many weeks on it. This is the Igeres HaTshuva, the letter regarding the idea of Tshuva. Some of the ideas will be familiar to us from the Rambam and the like. Not everything is absolutely path-breaking, but he does have some chidushim. I'll just say that the main practical chiddush, which is maybe not a chiddush, but it's a point to keep in mind, is tshuva is not only for sinners. Even the greatest tzaddikim have an obligation to do tshuva, and we'll have to discuss that. What is the tshuva of a righteous person who did nothing wrong? And we're going to talk about this, that tshuva primarily is not atoning for sin. Tshuva is growing in closeness to HaKadosh Baruch Hu. And therefore, tshuva is something everybody has to do. That actually is reminiscent of, not exactly the same, it's this Or Sameach story, that the Talmud of Or Sameach once met the Ger Rebbe, one of the Ger Rebbe's. And the Ger Rebbe said, "Where do you learn?" And the guy said, "I learn in Or Sameach," but he hastened to, "but I'm not a Baal tshuva," meaning I come from a religious family. So the Ger Rebbe said, "Not a Baal tshuva. Why not? Why aren't you a Baal Tshuva? How could a Jew not be a Baal Tshuva?" So we'll see. Tshuva is for everybody. Of course, the truth of the matter is, we're not perfect tzaddikim anyway, so even the literal definition of tshuva very much applies to us. But we'll see that even the person that's a tzaddik, based on the Tanya's definition of a tzaddik, still has a chiyuv of doing tshuva. So, Mr. Yes, I have to say. So next week, Yeshiva has this mentors thing in Tzfat. So there will be no shir next week. So there will be Mishnah 2 weeks. Okay, good week. Yeah.
Where can I find a copy of
You can get it in a bookstore. But if you check, I think if you check HebrewBooks.org, you familiar with that website? It's a great website that you get 50,000 Sfarim for free. You can type in Hebrew Mishnas Chasidim, it'll come up. Okay.